content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig deeper into the theme of the October issue of Our State Magazine, which is Mountain Masterpieces. Our first article is The Hidden Life of Biltmore. The most famous house in Asheville is known for its sheer size and lavish features. A closer look at the beauty built into its very walls reveals George Vanderbilt's love of art, literature, and exquisite views around his chosen home. A rooftop tour at Biltmore combines views of the natural beauty surrounding the estate with stories of man-made art that lurks like a gargoyle around every corner. Asheville, 1895. Winter in the Northeast is a misery, and the friends and family of George Vanderbilt are keen to trade bitter cold and chilly ocean winds for the temperate mountains of North Carolina. Over the past 6 years, a grand estate that George calls Biltmore has emerged from the hills and woods near Asheville, and soon this hand-picked group of guests will be the first to celebrate here. Few in their party have seen the house in progress, but each is familiar with George's grandiose taste, and expectations are high for tonight's Christmas Eve celebration and tomorrow's festivities. Although future guests will arrive in carriages, private train cars deliver this group directly up to the house via a rail line left over from construction. From the train windows, they see the house for the first time. Biltmore stands at the end of a long green lawn. Its roof is crowned with gilded scrollwork featuring George's monogram. There, just above the front doors, perhaps, George stands on his balcony, waving welcome. Waving from this balcony here in the observatory, one of George's private chambers, says Billy Young, who's leading a rooftop tour of Biltmore. He pauses long enough to usher his charges onto the spot where George would have stood. Even now, it's easy to envision a caravan of carriages emerging from the woods. Young lets spill a secret, one of many he reveals on the tour. At the top of the upper lawn, there's a statue of Diana, goddess of the hunt, as you step onto this balcony, as George did innumerable times, you're eye to eye with her. From here, Diana looks tiny, her place in the pantheon reduced to a human scale, putting her on equal footing with the mortals who meet her gaze. Changing direction, Young continues. Around the corner, we have a cheeky little joke from one of the stonemasons. The group follows the docent's gesture and shuffles along the narrow ledge. As each person rounds the corner, sidling past a grotesque, they giggle. The stone figure's bum, sans tail, is planted firmly on the rail. This is the kind of detail you don't see or want seen from the ground, he says. Indeed, from the terrace outside the library, you can't spy the irreverent grotesque, and you'd never know that the bear, balanced on a balcony above, holds a dripping honey jar. But from the ground to the rooftop, docents like Young reveal details that unlock the secrets and hidden layers living in Biltmore's artistry. At the beginning of each tour, Young gathers his groups around an Italian Renaissance wellhead carved from a single piece of pink Rosso di Verona marble. We start our rooftop tour on the ground because we want you to experience the house the way those first guests must have done so, and the way his wife Edith did when they arrived after their honeymoon, he says, full of wonder and awe. Stone latticework wraps around each column, its diamond pattern filled with oak leaves and acorns or fleur-de-lis, the shapes echoing one another. Young points out a frog, two cherubs with abs, intricate and identical scrollwork, all carved by hand. There in one corner, high above the terrace, perches a cartoonish, wild-eyed chicken. Young walks and talks, pirouetting with practiced grace as he glides into the house and up the spiraling grand staircase. He points out faces in the stone, more oak leaves and acorns, and a shield adorned with a boar's head. the crest of the Kissam family on George's mother's side, he explains. His circuitous route leads to the roof above the grand staircase. We're on the dome supporting the giant chandelier that hangs in the grand staircase, he says. It's a marvel held in place by one nut. But that's not the most interesting thing. We know exactly who installed it and when they did the work. The laborers took it upon themselves to carve their names and the date, 1218, into the plaster. Keep in mind that George opened the house on Christmas Eve, so they were working down to the wire. A patina covers the copper ridge that caps the roof, and on it, panels alternate between a stylized GV and the acorn motif. When those Christmas Eve guests arrived, and when George's wife Edith saw the house after their honeymoon, those were gilded, Young says. In a few places, you can find flakes of gold leaf clinging to the copper. One domed roof is shining in stylized laurel leaves, another in thick slate. And if you follow the improbably steep roofline over the observatory, you find an outlier, a dual crest. One half acorns, the other half an eagle, combining George and Edith's family crests. Fall, 1898. George and Edith arrive in Asheville fresh off a four-month honeymoon spent touring the art museums and galleries of Venice and Vienna while staying in a villa in Stresa, Italy. The couple floats from train to platform to the carriage that will deliver them to Biltmore. Edith, a Gilded Age aristocrat in her own right, must have an idea of what to expect from her new home, but George, never one to do anything halfway, has surprises in store for his new wife. It takes their carriage 45 minutes to make the trip up the approach road, and every few paces there's a cluster of employees waving and welcoming the couple. Edith's anticipation surely grows as they wind through the forest. Despite her efforts to see through the thinning leaves, the house remains hidden. Then they reach the gate. GV stands out in gold, the letters dividing as the gate opens and their carriage turns, giving her the first look at Biltmore. On the lawn, she spots a giant horseshoe of goldenrod flowers and the message, "Good luck." When Edith first experienced Biltmore, she would have seen the gilded designs along the ridge of the roof, felt at home among the portraits and sculptures inside, but were there details that went unnoticed for a time? Standing in the winter garden, she did notice a bell tucked away in a high corner like a forgotten secret, or were her eyes drawn to Carl Bitter's boy-stealing-geese statue hiding among the foliage? In the cavernous banquet hall hangs five tapestries, each as big as a living room. Though they are impossible to miss, the details within them often go unseen by many. They're too awed by the 40-foot-long table and enormous pipes stretching from the organ in the balcony. In one tapestry's threads is a classic love triangle, Venus, her lover Mars, and her husband Vulcan. Vulcan's nearly caught them en flagrant, but some censor's brush has applied a few strokes of red paint. Every house tour slows down in the library, and for good reason. The walls are lined with French walnut shelves. Drawers hold George's self-devised card catalog and notes on the 3,159 books he'd read. And then there's the showstopper overhead. The Chariot of Aurora, 62 by 32 feet, fills the ceiling with tempestuous clouds, a host of angels, an aurora welcoming dawn. Look up as you exit and you'll spot a red rooster caught in mid-crow, looking down on George's 10,300-plus leather-bound tomes. At the final stop on Young's rooftop tour, he gives the group a moment to study the view of Mount Pisgah, once the limit of the Biltmore estate, and the ocean of hills between here and there. This is the balcony off George's rooms and adjacent to Edith's suite, an intimate spot, stony faces, figures, and crests show at every window. Griffins frame a shield and its raised V. Cherubs hold the oaky crest of the Vanderbilts and the boar's head motif of the Kissams. One griffin clings to the wall in a place where corner meets roof. It must have been nearly impossible to carve. You can picture the sculpture wedged into that tight space. Hammer blows weak from lack of leverage, dust and chips falling in his face as he coaxed this creature of myth from the stone. One tour taker holds up his phone to get a shot of the landscape. He turns and snaps a selfie with his fiancée. She grins and holds up her hand to show off her new ring, and Mount Pisgah and the rolling hills of the Biltmore State behind them. It's not hard to imagine another happy couple standing out on a Biltmore balcony more than 120 years ago. Fall, 1898. By the end of her first day at Biltmore, Edith has begun to get to know her new home. Taking in the architecture and art that George has selected, she'll quickly adapt to her role as lady of the house, and in the coming years her good cheer and skill as hostess will be well known among their family and friends. But for now, George and Edith step onto the balcony outside the observatory. Night has fallen, shrouding the distant Mount Pisgah in the darkness. The couple watches as workers carrying torches converge on a parade on the vista while the Biltmore band plays a march. Overhead, fireworks light up the sky in celebration of the Vanderbilts' new life together. For more information about Biltmore, check out biltmore.com. And I want to go back into the story and tell you a little bit about some of the photos that are here. Near the beginning of the story, you see the long green lawn that leads up to the terrace on the opposite side of the house. And the photo is taken from that vantage point, looking back toward the house with its slate roofs and, all the different, the staircase that you can see on the left, imagine, and the conservatory on the right. On the upper lawn, a statue of Diana, goddess of the hunt, surveys the Biltmore house with its gargoyles, grotesques, and a stone bear holding a honey pot. And we see a picture of that stone bear that there was described in the article. On the rooftop tour, guests stand atop the copper dome supporting the chandelier that hangs in the grand staircase. The fixture is suspended by a single bolt, and then we have a picture of this chandelier, which is 1, 2, 3 levels, and I'm assuming at one point there were real candles that were lit, and these, of course, are now electric candles, and refitted for that, but it extends from all the way down through the staircase, and in a picture you show, there's a show of the, a photo of the folks on the rooftop tour, and in the backgrounds you see the mountains, and it's a sunset view of that. With its 70-foot-high barrel-vaulted ceiling, the banquet hall draws the eye upward. Look a little lower to see the frieze carved by Carl Bitter over the triple fireplace and the 16th-century Flemish tapestries on the wall. So these tapestries about a third of the way up, so they themselves are rather tall. There's a huge banquet table lined on either side with a number of chairs and other, red upholstered chairs around. And then there's also looks like a little sitting area, but there's a wooden, it's almost like, I would say it pictures like a throne almost with a wooden backdrop that rises above with the ornamentation on top. Then you have the huge fireplace. It's three fireplaces adjacent to each other that make that a huge fireplace. And above that is the frieze that's been described, this Carl Bitter's carving that is just fabulous detail. You also have chandeliers hanging down, you have the tapestries on the wall. It's very beautiful, ostentatious, actually. And then here's a last picture here. It says, before George Vanderbilt met Edith Dresser, Biltmore was a tribute to his passions. A statue of Joan of Arc, points to his interest in French culture, and a library crowned with the Chariot of Aurora reflects his love of reading. And so, yes, on the outside, you see this, there's a statue of Joan of Arc, dressed in armor and holding a standard, and above the front entrance. And then you have the Chariot of Aurora, and the chicken that was mentioned in the article, on the ceiling of the library. There's a little sub-article here that I'll read. Every North Carolinian knows the iconic outline of the Biltmore House. Few may recognize the influence that architect Richard Sharp Smith went on to have in places like Biltmore Village. The Biltmore Ripple. For architect Richard Sharp Smith, the grandest home in America was just the beginning. His signature Biltmore style left a lasting legacy around the city of Asheville, across western North Carolina, and beyond. Echoes of Biltmore sound across Asheville. More than reflections of the home and the estate, they're remnants of the architectural legacy left by Richard Sharp Smith, the supervising architect on George Vanderbilt's monumental project. Smith, employed by the firm of Richard Morris Hunt, was on the hunt for the build, overseeing a legion of craftsmen. After Hunt died in the summer of 1895, Smith stayed on at Biltmore, seeing it through to completion. By fall of 1896, he'd hung out his shingle and opened his own architectural firm in Asheville. You'll find his work across the estate and around town. He acted as the architect for many later changes to the Biltmore House, like adding a sleeping porch on the bachelor's wing quarters and reconfiguring Edith Vanderbilt's closet and bathroom space. And he planned the lion's share of Biltmore Village, steps from the entrance to the estate. In the village, everything save for four structures, the depot, the Cathedral of All Souls, the rectory, and the estate offices, bears the mark of Smith. That charming yellow rough-cast stucco called pebble dash, those exposed timbers, the curved rake boards, the multi-paned windows, and the overside doors, all Smith. And Dale Wayne Slusser, an architectural historian and member of the Preservation Society of Asheville, and Buncombe County's PSABC Board of Directors, adds another hallmark to that list. The mass of the homes, he says. They have a presence and personality indicative of Smith's involvement. Kevin Frazier agrees. As the owner of Asheville by Foot, Frazier leads tours of many buildings and neighborhoods that showcase Smith's legacy. The pebble dash, the thoughtful and restrained application of whatever style he was designing in, the very presence of a house or building. They all can point to Smith, he says. He was quite prolific, so you'll find his fingerprint everywhere. Prolific is an understatement. According to Frazier, Smith completed at least 30 homes in the Montford neighborhood alone. He designed the Young Men's Institute on the corner of Eagle and South Market Streets. As the Grove Park neighborhood was emerging, he had designed a sales office that now houses PSABC. The Annie West House at 189 Chestnut Street, the Charles Jordan House at 296 Montford Avenue, and the courthouses in Henderson, Jackson, Madison, and Swain counties are all Smith creations. After his death in 1924, his protege, Charles N. Parker, brought his style into the newly developed town of Biltmore Forest. Neighborhoods in this community express Smith's architectural viewpoint, carrying it forward for future generations. To learn more about Smith and the Preservation Society devoted to protecting Buncombe County's architectural history, visit psabc.org. That's P like Papa, S like Sierra, A as in Alpha, B as in Bravo, C as in Charlie.org. Well, let's switch gears and pull an article from the Murphy DeManio section entitled An Apple Alley Treat Tour. A bushel a peck, oh what the heck. For a full taste of this region, we insist that you sample the sweet stuff. Here's our guide to glazed, sugar-coated, and can't-miss farm fare. On a stretch of U.S. Highway 64 winding between Hendersonville and Batcave, fall colors flash past the car windows, a tunnel of golden yellow leaves, bright blue October sky, and endless red and green of apple orchards flush with fruit. This is Apple Alley, where along just a 6-mile stretch of highway, you'll find 14 orchards and roadside produce stands. Folks have grown apples here since 1783, when the first pioneer families, the Barnwells, Colstons and Freemans, the Justices, Lancasters and Steps, plus more than a dozen others, arrived in the area with fruit tree seedlings to plant near their newly built log cabin homesteads. They soon discovered that the warm days, cool nights, and fertile soil in this area of the southern Appalachian Mountains were particularly favorable for growing red and golden apples, and they enjoyed their bounty fresh, fried, dried, and pressed, preserved in jellies and butter, and of course, baked into delicious pies and cakes. Nearly 250 harvests later, 80% of North Carolina's apples are grown in Henderson County by roughly 100 farmers who produce about 4 million bushels of the fruit each year. And we have a photo here of an apple just bursting off the page. 5 generations of justices have grown apples in Henderson County. In recent years, farms like theirs have upped the autumn appeal with cider, tours, playgrounds, and sweet treats. And here you see these apples are, they have red and pinks in them and golden colors, so they look like they're ready to eat. Along 6 miles of Route 64, you'll find Justice Orchard, Steps Hillcrest Orchard, and Mountain Fresh Orchards, where you'll want to pick up a warm apple fritter or two. And we have a little boy who's excited to be holding a peck of golden apples. Most of today's growers are descendants of those first settlers, and they're carrying on a hard-working tradition. Over the years, an increasing number of apple growers have added agritourism to their operations, with the first you-pick apples advertised in the late 1960s. Now, these family farms are mountain meccas from late August through the peak of leaf-peeping season in October, offering bucketfuls of freshly picked fruit. Orchard frolicking, hay rides, corn mazes, barnyards, and even playgrounds. And most importantly, to those like me with tremendous sweet tooth, dozens upon dozens of traditional and inventive apple treats at on-site bakeries, turnovers, fritters, and donuts, slushies and sundaes and ciders, cakes and pies and loaves of bread, delicately dusted with cinnamon sugar and dunked in hot cider, covered in caramel, topped with a scoop of vanilla ice cream. It would be a true shame, I think, not to try all of them. Surely one snack must reign supreme. What better way to find out than by taking an Apple Alley treat tour? So, first on the treat tour is Mountain Fresh Orchards. As I drive east out of Hendersonville through Apple Alley along Highway 64, a big red arrow on an old sign, Gala, fresh fried pies, cider donuts, apple butter, points me directly to my first stop, the roadside market and bakery at Mountain Fresh Orchards, a 36-year-old family farm. It's still early, and the orchard's leafy cheese are catching the fall day's first golden light as the clouds begin to lift. I head inside, where I'm greeted by the sweet scent of fried dough and cinnamon, and I'm immediately faced with what I know will be the biggest challenge of this adventure, pacing myself. To kick things off, I order a warm apple fritter, soft dough, pieces of apple, and cinnamon folded together, fried, and then drenched with a sugary glaze. It pulls apart and pairs perfectly with a cup of hot apple cider. This is going to be a piece of cake, maybe literally. Number 2, Granddad's Apples and Such. About 30 seconds further down 64, I come upon an enormous gray and red barn with a silo and a John Deere tractor on top. Pat and Leslie Lancaster run Granddad's on land that's been farmed by their family for nearly 100 years. Out back, a cornfield stretches in toward the rolling mountains in the distance. Before me are dozens of huge wooden bins filled with apples in shades of speckled green and yellow, deep maroon and pale pink, and little signs displaying their names: Evercrisp, Cameo, Arkansas Black, Gold Rush. I pick out a half a peck to take home, but I know I need to focus on my pursuit of the sweeter stuff. I join a long line of people waiting to order from an extensive menu at the bakery, and soon I'm faced with a decision. vanilla ice cream sandwich between two apple cider donuts, or a mountain glacier and apple cider slushy topped with soft serve vanilla ice cream and crumbled caramel apple cookies. I choose the glacier. It's now 10:37 in the morning. It's ridiculous. It's the best thing I've ever tasted. It's also very filling. What's that they say about the dessert compartment? I'm pretty sure that doesn't apply when everything you eat is a dessert. Before venturing on to my next stop, I half-heartedly stretch by the corn maze and wander through the pumpkin patch in the hopes that I'll magically burn 2,000 calories in the next few moments. Number 3, Justice Orchard. A 5-minute drive off 64, my map shows that I'm in the unincorporated community of Fruitland, which is appropriately named, brings me to the gravel driveway at Justice Orchard, where 5 generations of the Justice family have cultivated this land for well over 100 years. I pass row upon row of apple trees, each staked with a wooden sign noting the variety. Among them, families pull carts holding basketfuls of freshly picked fruit. I remind myself of my mission as I sidle up to the window at Apple House Bakery. I already know what I want, a handmade fried apple pie. Still, I can't help but admire the donuts rolling off the conveyor belt. Do I also need a donut, I wonder? Oh no, donut distraction. I fight an internal battle before forcing myself to preserve the ever-shrinking room I have left in my belly for my last stop. Luckily, I'm distracted from my donut despair as the cashier passes me a warm hand pie on a paper plate. It's golden brown and perfectly crispy on the outside, but just one bite reveals its sweet, soft center made with Mutsu apples. It's an old-fashioned tradition at Justice, and now I think that coming here and getting one of these will be my fall tradition. Last but not least, number 4, Steps Hillcrest Orchard. The only way to end an Apple Alley treat tour with the most classic treat of them all, an apple cider donut. But I am regrettably, incredibly full and quite sleepy as I pass by the sprawling pick-your-own pumpkin patch and rows of apple trees on my way to the market at Steps. My sugar rush-induced second wind from Justice is beginning to wane. The sound of an apple cannon helps perk me up a little, but I'm running on borrowed time. At the Apple House, I pick up half a dozen apple cider donuts to take home with me. One more bite. I pull out a single cakey donut, completely covered in sparkling cinnamon sugar, and I eat the whole thing. I came in on a mission, after all. In the end, the day was so delicious that I'm not sure I could pick a favorite stop or a favorite treat. But after a mere sampling of what Apple Alley has to offer, I can confidently say that the ancestors of today's Henderson County apple growers would be astounded by the fruits of their labor. For more information, visit ourstate.com/appleorchards. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or Brent impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. And so long until next time.